The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much. And thank you to the Free Library for inviting me here this evening. I've just been shown a copy of the program, and I'm told that this is, you know, not the first year that the Free Library has invited distinguished writers to appear here. Can you all hear me at the back? I should talk up a little bit. Okay. So I'm told that this is not the first year that the Free Library has invited writers to appear here, in my ignorance, of course. And I have to say, it's slightly daunting seeing some of these names here, because obviously, the bar has been set somewhere high, and you're used to rather good speakers appearing before you. And so I'm slightly worried that the usual rubbish I come up with may not pass muster. But I'll plow on anyway. thank you. It's good to be here in Philadelphia. Some of you may have read this book, or may be aware of what is in the book in general terms. And you'll be aware that Netherland touches on the subject of cricket. And I have to say that one of the reasons I'm glad to be in Philadelphia is because over the years I've played cricket for Staten Island Cricket Club, just like Hans van den Broek does, who is the narrator of this book. And we and I have often played cricket here in Philadelphia, which is, as I'm sure many of you know, the spiritual home of cricket in America. And I played at those clubs which were in the 19th century cricket clubs to a very high standard, Germantown, Marion, Philadelphia Cricket Club, and also Haverford. I've also played there. And slightly less grandly, I played at Fairmount Park, and also at a new ground in a part of town which many of you, I'm sure, are not familiar with, which is situated on the rather unfortunately named Dick Avenue. And of course, you know, it's a long drive from New York, so we always spend about an hour and a half just talking about Dick Avenue and or whether, you know, calling up the other cars and saying, do you know where we can find Dick? Are you on Dick yet? It just goes on and on. And in fact, I'm happy to spend the next half an hour talking about Dick. But I'm told the format here, and it's a format I'm very happy with, is that I'm going to be reading some pages, and that afterwards there will be the opportunity for you to ask questions or otherwise interact with me. What I propose to do is to read, is first of all to get out my timepiece, just keep track of where we are, and then to read this first section. Hans is a Dutch banker. He's been left in New York in the aftermath of 9/11, and in the aftermath also of his wife's departure. She's English, back to London, taking their son with them. And he decides, for rather mysterious reasons, to get an American driver's license. Sometimes to walk in shaded parts of Manhattan is to be inserted into a Magritte. You see the accent. The street is night while the sky is day. It was into one such dreamlike double-dealing evening in January 2003 at Herald Square that I stumbled out of the building occupied by New York's Department of Motor Vehicles. After years of driving rental cars with a disintegrating and legally dubious international license issued in the United Kingdom, I had finally decided to buy and insure a car of my own, which required me to get an American driver's license. but I couldn't trade my British license, itself derived from a Dutch one, for an American one. Such an exchange was for some unexplainable reason only feasible during the first 30 days of an alien's permanent residence in the United States. That is a fact. Why this rule exists is a mystery to me. Because in your first 30 days of arrival in the United States, you're not really thinking about your driver's license, but anyway. I would have to get a learner permit and submit to a driving test all over again, which entailed, as a first step, a written examination on the rules of the road of the Empire State. At the time, I didn't question this odd ambition or my doggedness in relation to it. I can say quite ingenuously that I was attempting to counter the great subtractions that had lessened my life, and that the prospect of an addendum, even one as slight as a new license and a new car, seemed important at the time, and no doubt I was drawn to a false syllogism involving the nothingness of my life and the somethingness of doing. All that said, I didn't let Rachel, his wife, know what I was up to. She would have taken my actions as a statement of intent, and maybe she wouldn't have been entirely wrong. It would not have helped much to point out that if I was indeed embracing an American lot, then I was doing so unprogrammatically, even unknowingly. Perhaps the relevant truth, and it's one whose existence was apparent to my wife, and I'm sure to much of the world, long before it became apparent to me, is that we all find ourselves in temporal currents, and that unless you're paying attention, you'll discover, often too late, that an undertow of weeks or of years has pulled you deep into trouble. Carried along then by the dark flow of those times, I approached the Department of Motor Vehicles. The DMV was in a building coated in black glass, and chiefly identifiable by a large sign for Daffy's, an entity I took to be somehow connected to Daffy Duck, but which turned out to be a department store. I avoided Daffy's and Modell's Sporting Goods and Mrs. Fields' Cookies and Hat and Cap and Payless and Payless. Is it Payless or Payless? I like the sound of Payless. sounds like this library, free. Payless shoe sauce, tongue twister. And other occupants of the eerily unfrequented mall known as the Herald Center. By taking the express elevator to the 8th floor, a bell for the benefit of the blind burped at intervals as I rose. Then the elevator door halved and slid away, and I stood before the DMV premises. There was a static turnstile, like a monster's unearthed skeleton, and there was a set of doors in constant use. Approaching these, I was barged into by a middle-aged woman making her exit. "Get out of my way," she sobbed. I joined the line to the reception desk, where two sweating men furiously gave directions. "I'm here for the written test," I said. "You got your Social Security card, ID?" "Yes," I said, reaching for my pocket. "I don't want to see it," the man snapped, thrusting forms at me. I entered the main administrative area. The low ceiling was supported by an extraordinary clutter of columns. So many, in fact, that I could not avoid the perverse impression that the room was in danger of collapsing. An enormous counter ran around three-quarters of the office like a fortification, and behind it, visible between crenellations made by partitions and computer terminals, were the DMV employees. Two of them, women in their 30s, screened with laughter by a photocopying machine, but as soon as they reached their positions at the counter, they wore faces of sullen hostility. One could understand why, for assembled before them was a perpetually reinforced enemy, its troops massing relentlessly on the hard, pew-like benches. Many of those seated were hunched forward with hands clasped and heads bowed, raising their eyes only to follow the stupendous figures, E-923, A-062, C568 that randomly appeared on screens with the purpose never achieved of moderating the agony of suspense in which visitors were placed. I filled out my application form and stood in the queue of those waiting to be photographed. After my photograph was taken, I was told to sit on a bench and wait. My green card, which I'd handed over as proof of identity, would have to be checked by the Department of Homeland Security. An hour or so later, approval was forthcoming. I waited another 20 minutes, and then shuffled with a handful of others to the desk, to the test area, which was furnished with that heart-sinking grid of desks and chairs familiar to examinees everywhere. There were requests for test sheets in Chinese, French, Spanish. I rapidly answered the multiple-choice questions and handed my sheet to the invigilator. It gave me a childish satisfaction to have finished before anyone else. I returned to my desk and waited for the examination period to expire. The invigilator, an obese Hispanic woman, marked erroneous answers with superb strokes of her pencil. When she came to my paper, the pencil hovered and hovered. Then she scribbled 20 out of 20 and handed it to me with a frown. I experienced a rush of happiness. Now, at last, I could collect my learner permit. I received a ticket. This is a man who's driven for many, many, many years without incident. I received a ticket, say D499, and further instructions to wait. So I waited. Perplexed and rebuffed Chinese men wandered everywhere. I listened to 106.7 Light FM and watched a television screen on which entertainment news, rather than actual entertainment, was broadcast. I studied driving safety posters. You snooze, you lose, it was said. At last, my number came up. A balding man inspected my paperwork all over again. It fell to applicants to produce proof of identity worth 6 points. A green card scored 3 points. An original social security card, 2 points. And a credit card or a bank statement or a utilities bill, a single point. The man shook his head. "Sorry," he said, unapologetically pushing my documents back to me. "What's wrong?" I asked. "I can't take the credit card. It's got somebody else's name on it." I looked. My name, which by a miracle of typography was fully spelled out on my social security card as Johannes Franciscus Hendrikus van den Broek. My credit card, for obvious reasons, identified me merely as Johannes F.H. van den Broek, exactly as my green card did. "That's my name. I don't want to talk about it. Go see the supervisor, count of 10, next." I went to count of 10. There were 3 people already in line. Each had an argument with the supervisor. Each went away in a rage. Then it was my turn. The supervisor was in his late 30s with a severely shaved head and a little goatee and an earring. He wordlessly extended his hands, and I passed him my documents of identification. In exchange, he passed me a notice. All forms of identification must show the same name. He quickly compared my papers. "You've got to show me documents with the same name," he said. "This Con Ed bill is no good." "Wait a minute," I said. I pulled out a bank statement I brought along in case of difficulty. It, too, was in the name of Johannes F.H. van den Broek. But it contained copies of checks I'd written. "You see," I said, "the signature on those checks is exactly the same as the signature on my social security card and green card. So it's obviously me in both cases." He shook his head. "I'm not a handwriting expert," he said. "I need the same name." "Okay," I said calmly. But let me ask you this. The green card's good, right? And the name on the Con Ed bill and the bank statement is the same name as the name on the green card. The supervisor re-examined my green card. Actually, you've got yourself another problem, he said with a smile. See this? The name on the green card is not the same as the name on the Social Security card. I looked. On the green card was typed Johannes with one N. I'd never noticed it before. I said, yes, well, that's an obvious clerical error made by the INS. The photograph on the green card is obviously me. The supervisor looked unmoved, so I added, either that, or there's somebody out there who looks exactly like me and who has exactly the same name, and I happen to have stolen his green card. Not exactly the same name, the supervisor said, and that's where we have a problem. You want me to give you a learner permit? Okay, but who are you? Are you Yoanus? He pronounced the last two syllables as an obscenity. Or are you Johannes? Come on, let's not play games, I said. You think I'm playing a game? He was actually baring his teeth. Let me remind you, sir, you seem to be in possession of somebody else's green card. Either that or somebody else's social security card. I might just get suspicious about that. I might just have to start looking into that. This man was dangerous, I realized. I said, you really want me to go down to the INS and get a new green card? Is that what you want to get out of this? I don't want you to go there, the supervisor said. Now he was pointing at my chest. I'm forcing you to go there. What about my written test? I said, pathetically showing him my 20 out of 20. He smiled. You're going to have to take it again. And so I was in a state a fuming helplessness when I stepped out into the inverted obscurity of the afternoon. As I stood there, thrown by Herald Square's flows of pedestrians and the crazed traffic diagonals and the grey, seemingly bottomless gutter pools, I was seized for the first time by a nauseating sense of America, my gleaming adopted country, under the secret actuation of unjust, indifferent powers. The rinsed taxis, hissing over fresh slush, shone like grapefruits, but if you looked down into the space between the road and the undercarriage, where icy matter stuck to pipes and water streamed down the mud flaps, you saw a foul mechanical dark. And I just want to read a little bit which meant about in honor of this venue and of this town, city, I should say, a couple of pages dealing with the cricket theme. I'm going to refrain from summarizing the book. Well, I know I will summarize the book just to put this into context. As I said, Hans is left alone in New York by himself, and what he does is he starts playing cricket out of loneliness. It's a childhood game which he returns to. And he meets a Trinidadian entrepreneur called Chuck Ramkasoon, whose dream it is to build a cricket stadium. And Chuck, he finds himself on Chuck's emailing list. Often Chuck's emails simply provided links to websites he found interesting, but when the message was concerned with his cricket undertaking, he's trying to build a stadium in New York, he might give us the benefit of his own musings. One such memorandum was headed, "Not an immigrant sport." Its text, still preserved in my electronic filing cabinet, was as follows. Cricket was the first modern team sport in America. It came before baseball and football. Cricket has been played in New York since the 1770s. The first international team sports fixtures anywhere were cricket matches between the USA and Canada in the 1840s and 1850s. In those days, cricket matches in New York were watched by thousands of fans. It was a professional sport reported in all the newspapers. There were clubs all over the country, in Newark, Schenectady, Troy, Albany, San Francisco, Boston, Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, Kentucky, Baltimore, and Philadelphia. In Philadelphia alone, there were dozens of clubs, and the magnificent facilities of Philadelphia Cricket Club, Marion Cricket Club, and Germantown Cricket Club are still standing today. The fields are mostly used for lawn tennis. It was not until the First World War that the sport went into sharp decline for complicated reasons. So it is wrong to see cricket in America as most people see it, i.e. an immigrant sport. It is a bona fide American pastime and should be regarded as such. All those who have attempted to introduce cricket to the American public have failed to understand this. Cricket is already in the American DNA. With proper promotion, marketing, government support, etc., awareness of the game could easily be reawakened. American kids could once again play their country's oldest team sport. One recipient of this missive copied his reply to all of Chuck's addressees. Whoever, could you please stop sending me crazy junk mail? Although I glanced at them, I didn't respond to Chuck's communications. My instinct was to keep him at a distance. And that at that distance, certainly, that we introduce between ourselves and those we suspect of neediness. I was wondering, for example, when he was going to ask me for money for his cricket scheme. But I was also drawn to Chuck. I had him down as a lover of contingencies and hypotheses, a man cheerfully operating in the subjunctive mood. The business world is densely margined by dreamers, men almost invariably, whose longing selves willingly submit to the enchantment of projections and pie charts and crisply totted numbers, who toy and toy for years like novelists with the same sheaf of documents, who slip out of bed in the middle of the night to pitch to a pyjamaed reflection in a window pane. I've never been open to the fantastical aspect of business. I'm an analyst, a bystander. I lack entrepreneurial wistfulness. In other respects, of course, I'm as far away as they come. That winter, for example, when the Cricket World Cup was being played in Southern Africa and several old teammates of mine played for the Netherlands against the great Indians and Australians, I imagine that events long ago had taken a different turn and that in my youth I discovered the great secret of batting. Something to do with the position of the head, maybe, or the preliminary movement of the feet, or a special dedication of memory. With the result, I imagined further on those black mornings when I woke early to follow the Dutch matches on crickinfo.com's live scoreboard, that I was now one of those orange-clad Hollanders stationed on the pale lawns of Paarl and Potchefstroom, and that when Brett Lee, say, he's an Australian cricket bowler, took 20 sprinted strides towards me and leapt and hurled the white one-day ball at my toes, the 92-mile-per-hour blur came into focus and hung before me like a Christmas bauble, and with a simple push of my long-handled bat, I sent the ball gliding to the boundary's white rope. How many of us are completely free of such scenarios? Who hasn't known, a little shamefully, the joys they bring? I suspect that what keeps us harmless from them is not, as many seem to believe, the maintenance of a strict frontier between the kingdoms of the fanciful and the actual, but the contrary. The permitting of a benign annexation of the latter by the former, it's quite complicated when you're listening to it, so that our daily motions always cast a secondary, otherworldly shadow. And at those moments when we feel inclined to turn from the more plausible and hurtful meaning of things, we soothingly find ourselves attached to a companion, far-fetched sense of the world and our place in it. It's the incompleteness of reverie that brings trouble. That, one might argue, brought Chuck Ramkasoon the worst trouble of all. His head wasn't sufficiently in the clouds. He had a clear enough view of the gap between where he stood and where he wished to be, and he was determined to find a way across. Thank you very much. Well, I hope that DMV passage didn't bring back, didn't cause traumatic flashbacks for people. I'm still shaking just thinking, just reading that section out loud. Now, I think what we're going to do now is invite you to take part, and we have a microphone here so that, so that whoever raises their hand can be served by a microphone. And I'll do the pointing, just this gentleman there. Hold on, just there, the mic's on its way so that there'll be...
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for that book. It was beautiful and was a gift, and I loved it. I'm wondering if, I'm sure you've read about what our president said about your book and how he's reading it. I'm curious to know if our president at all directly or indirectly contacted you and what that blurb did for your sales.
Well, I think blurb is a rather disrespectful way of describing what I think is an acute piece of literary criticism. I'd rather not discuss what may or may not have transpired between me and the president, our president, as I may say, as a fellow American citizen. But obviously, I've recovered from the blow of his endorsement rather quickly. It's actually a great, you know, I've said this before, and on a radio show this morning, I think I may have said it this morning, and I apologize to those who may have heard it earlier, but it is in fact the answer I should give to that question, which is that on the one hand, I'm privately thrilled because Barack Obama is a man I supported right from the beginning. And indeed, I remember, playing cricket here in Philadelphia and having very interesting conversations with a lot of the Americans, West Indian Americans, who were very much involved in the grassroots work for Barack, as we all called him in those days. So I'm thrilled. But on the other hand, I'd like to sort of stand up for the world of the arts and the world of the artist and the contribution that artists are able to make to our view of things, and say that I grew up as many of us here did, I suspect, reading books and believing in the absolute importance of writing. And not because it was not for ideological reasons or for theoretical reasons, but simply because that was my experience as a young reader and as a person growing up. To read a book was a very valuable thing, and was a magical thing. And so, I'm on the one hand grateful that we have a president who recognizes this, but on the other hand, I sort of feel that presidents ought to read books. And it should be no more surprising than hearing that the president watches ESPN. Why is that a regular normal thing to expect? And why are we so what on earth is going on when we're so thrilled that the president has read a literary novel? I mean, it's so that's my second response to that. But my other on a more slightly practical note, I think it is good for presidents to read novels simply because they have such an asymmetrical relationship with the rest of the world. I mean, whenever anybody meets them, it's the most important moment in their lives, and for the president, it's almost invariably one of the least significant moments of their lives. And every time they do anything, they live in this. It's like the court of Louis XIV, the White House, and. And you just wonder how presidents are able to function in that strange world. I mean, it's just unreal. And my hope is that reading novels, and I'm very fortunate it happens to be this particular one, is a way for them to return to a more human scale. because at the end of the day, you're back, you're the reader, you're confronted with a novel which is a form of authority in the end. I mean, when one reads a book, one owns the book, obviously, and one owns one's interpretation of the book, but one also accords a great deal of authority to the book and to the text, and one is grateful for that. And I can't help but think that that would be a healthy thing for any person in that situation of power. So that's my answer to that question. Well, thank you very much. This lady over here.
I only bought your book a few days ago, as soon as I realized it was out in paperback, and I've just read the beginning. I know that several of the reviewers have likened it to The Great Gatsby, which is one of my favorite books, and I think it's probably one of the great American novels. I'm going to assume that you've read The Great Gatsby, and if you haven't read The Great Gatsby, that you at least know enough about it to say something cogent about your impressions of The Great Gatsby.
I not only have read The Great Gatsby, but I remember the question I was asked about it for my A-levels, which is the high school. And it's a question which completely flummoxed me, which was comment on the relation, the idea, something like comment on the theme of time in The Great Gatsby. asking a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old to comment on the theme of time. it's just ridiculous, really. And, I remember very distinctly that there came a moment when I suddenly realized that the theme of time was not a literary theme at all. And that it suddenly became a horribly real strand of one's own life. And that suddenly the world of memory and of bygone days is a very significant reality. Which is all too significant reality. But just going back to Gatsby, I am undoubtedly indebted to The Great Gatsby, not least of all for the plot. My book, as I realized halfway through it, has almost the same shaky plot as Gatsby. A man, a narrator, rather phlegmatic, who remembers his drowned, dreaming friend from a distance, having withdrawn from New York City. And I'm not giving anything away, because that is revealed in the first page or two. And of course the great themes struck by Gatsby are all contained in this book. But my more general feeling about Gatsby and Netherland is that I try to keep my distance from it, because no novel can come out well from a comparison to The Great Gatsby. It's such a marvelous and mysterious piece of writing. And so on the one hand, I'm indebted to it, but on the other hand, I'm slightly, overawed by it. Simply to give this microphone a bit of a workout, I think we'll go here.
Thank you. I would just like to say, in response to your rhetorical question, why is it surprising that a president should read literary history, that we all know the answer to that. Before your book was published, I was trying to get a friend who was a Pakistani who had sponsored a Gyanan, a young man sponsored and supported and housed a fellow through his high school and into college. And what they had in common originally was actually their love of the game of cricket from far away. And I had asked them to help explain the game to me. because I'd like to get involved with it. And I think they just thought I was too old, and they've never, ever responded to me to invite me out to the fields. When your book came out, I have to say, honestly, that one of the reasons I wanted to read it after the reviews was I wanted to learn more about cricket. You left me as frustrated as the protagonist at
Good.
The DMV. Did you do that deliberately?
Yeah, I mean, I bet you there's a couple of cricket players here. And they know as well as I do that it's just to describe, if you start sort of verbally trying to, talk about the game and explain it, you just run into all kinds of problems. Just as it's, but in essence, it's two teams, you see, that's not hard. There's a field, and what the teams are trying to do is get more runs than the other team. And it's that simple. With exceptions. it's not as quite as complicated as the card game bridge, which is, I've never understood. But, it really is, I think you have to play it. So, come down to Staten Island. We actually at the club got a guy who's an American guy from New Jersey who emailed us and said he's interested in coming along, and we now have one supporter. He comes, he claims to understand what's going on. He lives on a piece of deserted wasteland, essentially, just across the bridge, and in New Jersey, from just across the bridge from Staten Island, and because he's slightly older than the players, whenever he turns up, and because he's our only supporter, he's our only fan, he immediately gets a chair to sit on. And so you are a spring chicken, my friend, despite your, certainly in our team, you'd be considered an up-and-coming, promising youngster. So I would invite you, and indeed anyone, to come along and check out Staten Island on the web. We have a website. And also, I mean, there are some great clubs here in Philadelphia. And, actually the great thing about playing cricket in Fairmount Park is that, there's always some guys who turn up with their, food. So they're making food on the side and there's drinks that are available. And, I'm not sure how quite entirely legal all that is. But we've never had any problems, and they always know that the teams have traveled from New York. And, after a tough game, with the usual fighting, we always have a good time. So it is a good city. It's a good city. It's a good cricket city right here, I would suggest.
If I may ask, what motivated you to emigrate to the United States, and to what extent have your reasons for doing so been realized?
Well, I lived in London. My wife is American. And she was offered a job in New York, and this was in 98, actually the same year that he moved, Hans. And our plan was that I would finish my last book, which is a non-fiction book, and then I would return to London, we would return to London, and I would continue to combine writing with the practice of the law. I'm a lawyer by training. I was a lawyer for many years, a barrister with a wig and a gown. But that didn't work out because we just fell in love in New York and there wasn't really a plan. It was only once I'd been here for a while that I became interested by New York and I'm very happy there. And eventually I became, we have all these American children and so I thought I might as well become an American as well, just to sort of tidy up the paperwork. And I was delighted to get my citizenship just in time to take part in the primaries for this last election. And so far it's been a good experience being an American. We've been winning. this lady here.
A number of things from your book seem to be drawn from your life. I love the character of Chuck, and he's so fully drawn, and you feel like you know him,
yeah.
And that he's quintessential immigrant to New York or in New York. I wondered, was he drawn on somebody that you've known, or is it a composite?
It's a composite, but I'm only going to mention one guy. That is, when I was a lawyer, I used to do death penalty appeals from Trinidad. And I used to get all these letters from Death Row in Trinidad, and Death Row is just this section of the prison, the central prison in Port of Spain. And it's very moving because the air letters, the prisoners use air letters, which they write on and then fold, which they're given. And the air letters all have these marvelous birds on them, like the scarlet ibis. And it's very poignant to receive letters, because Trinidad is a famous island for its bird life. And as I know from, I've been there and I've actually seen the scarlet ibises. And in Caroni, I don't know if there are any Trinities here, but, so I went to Trinidad and I met when I was there, actually, they just started. It was a very interesting time to go because they just hanged 9 people in 3 days the week before. A very famous gangster called Dol Chedi and his cronies had all been hanged for a murder of a family. And all the guys from my legal chambers were involved in that case. Anyway, I went to see this one client on death row, and when I was there, I got to meet a guy called Ishmael Samad, who's a guy who left school at 14 and worked in a bookstore and read and educated himself, and because he was a brilliantly clever guy, became very, very knowledgeable about all sorts of things, including theology. He's a wonderful kind of amateur theologian. And he developed... He was the... On every Christmas Day, I'm not sure if he still does it, because there may be I'm not sure what the situation is. Because I'm no longer practicing, I don't know what this, I haven't followed the, I don't think that they've been hanged there, I don't think anyone's been hanged there for a little while now. But he would stand in front of the jail, and on his own on Christmas Day, and with signs from Arthur Koestler against the death penalty all day. And he was practically the only man on the island who was opposed to it, apart from the Catholic members of the Catholic Church there. And he was just an inspirational guy. I got him. He's a nature guide by profession, I suppose. And when Trinidad is visited by these wonderful sea turtles, the biggest turtles in the world, nest on the beaches of Trinidad. And in the 70s, the locals used to wait for the females to come ashore, and then they would chop their heads off and then eat them. With obviously, you know, bad consequences for the well-being of the turtle population. And, of course, the reason they do this isn't because they're sort of horrible people who hate turtles, but because, you have to feed your family, and this was a way of eating. You would eat the turtles. And Ishmael decided that this was wrong, and in the absence of government action, he would go out in the middle of the night to these remote beaches in northern Trinidad, which I visited myself, and I've been there at night time as well, and I can tell you they're not fun places to be. You have to walk through the mangroves and in certain cases to get to these beaches. And armed only with a khaki uniform, which he pretended was the uniform of a game warden, he would approach these men with their cutlasses and ask them not to kill the turtles, and they would. Not always, but often they would. And he did this for years, just on his own. Can you imagine the sort of person that is? Goes out in the middle of the night. Anyway, so I thought, this is a remarkable guy, and it enabled me to dream up this guy, Chuck Rampkasun, who has different ambitions, but is very clever and, energetic in the same sort of way and entertaining, just like my friend Ishmael is. So that's one inspiration for that character anyway.
Thank you.
A gentleman over here.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for an excellent book of literature. I mean, it's a pleasure to read.
Thank you very much.
What you wrote. I have a question regarding Hans's mother. There's three scenes that I can think of. One is when he plays hooky, and his mother magically appears behind him, skating,
yeah,
ice skating,
mm-hmm.
And doesn't really say anything about you better be in school, you know, etc.
Yeah.
Second scene is where they're biking across the bridge. I don't know what river it is. East
Brooklyn
or the
Bridge, yeah.
The Brooklyn Bridge, okay. And they're together there. And there's a later, toward the end of the book, there's a scene where they're on the ferry and viewing the sunset.
Staten Island Ferry, yeah.
Yes. And what is the significance of his mother in this novel? It seems like she is keeps reappearing and as a shadow almost. And,
yeah.
Maybe you can give me your take on that.
Well, my general first reaction to that is that I'm slightly reluctant to attribute, you know, to pin down any specific interpretation of any particular aspect of the book, because that's, I think, you know, the reader's prerogative, and you know, you resist pinning these things down, for a reason, but I am on the other hand quite gratified that you have asked me about the mother, because what happens in the novel, and we learn this at the beginning, so I'm not giving anything away, is that Hans's mother has died quite recently. This is before 9/11, and she lived in Holland while he lived in New York, and he flew back for her funeral. And he's obviously very marked by this death and by this absence. And he remembers his mother when he was playing cricket as a youngster, sitting on the side of the field with her chair all day, marking the homework. She was a teacher. And watching him. And I think that, I would only say this, that, everybody needs to feel witnessed in the world. And if you lose your witness, even if that person is overseas, then I think if as a result of, you know, the death of one's mother, you feel unseen in the world, and Hans says that at a certain point, I think that maybe suggests that you are unseen, and that maybe you're, you know, which if you're married is a slightly, raises certain questions about how well the marriage is working. And so I think that, the question of seeing, our duty to see people, and the question of this quest for vision is a very important part of the book. You know, what are we supposed to see? Hans is always looking out of windows, always looking under things, always looking at different perspectives. And he's constantly trying to see things and trying to understand what it is that we should be looking at. And it's the old, age-old search for meaning, which, as I understand it, never quite ends in life. And I think one of the reasons he likes Chuck is because Chuck sees him. You know, it takes this guy with a completely different background to see him. And I think Chuck simultaneously feels seen by Hans, who's able to understand and appreciate how much work he must do to succeed as a business guy. Maybe Chuck doesn't quite feel that he gets that from, you know, fellow immigrants that he runs into, and he values Hans possibly for this reason. That's it. Right, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information is available at freelibrary.org.